Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Professor Daniel Dreisbach. He's in the School of Public Affairs at American University in the Department of Justice, Law, and Society. He is a prolific author. Dan, you've got about a dozen books under your belt, I think, as author or editor, including Thomas Jefferson and the Wall of Separation Between Church and State. That's from 2002. Why Jefferson? I mean, the Wall of Separation Between Church and State, that's in the First Amendment, Dan.
Well, thanks for pointing that out. I'd missed that. You know, it is hard to have a conversation about church-state relationships, what the Constitution has to say about church-state issues, without encountering this metaphor of a wall of separation. So it seemed like a good topic. I think of that book as a biography of a metaphor, if you will. And it is one that has had a tremendous influence on how we think about church-state issues in America.
It's amazing. It's an amazing story how this line in the letter Jefferson wrote during his presidency has become really the same status of free speech and the Second Amendment, right to bear firearms. People, this wall of separation, it's really extraordinary how that happened. But we'll leave that to another time, and you've written the book about this. He also did Reading the Bible with the Founding Fathers. That's from 2017 with Oxford Press. Co-editor of a book that is used, I think this is used in many classrooms as a textbook, called The Sacred Rights of Conscience. Am I correct?
That is correct. Yes, it is. I hear from teachers all the time who use that book. It's an anthology of primary source documents, going back to even biblical sources, but mid-last millennium political theorists, what they had to say on church and state, religious liberty. But primarily, it is focused on discussions of religious liberty in the American experience from the first permanent settlements in British North America up through the early Republic, so right into the early 19th century. It includes many, many familiar texts, but also, I am sure, many sources that will be unfamiliar to most readers. These are state papers, private papers, letters, political sermons, all kinds of texts, but focused on this topic of the sacred rights of conscience, religious liberty in the American political experiment.
And this book is a necessary history because so much of the religious grounds, the Christian grounds, the Judeo-Christian grounds of our jurisprudence have been obscured in, what, the last 100 years, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that's true. It's worth reminding ourselves that those first pilgrims in 1620, followed by the Puritans in 1630, came to these shores to establish what were essentially Bible commonwealths. That is to say, polities that would be shaped by biblical law, biblical concepts.
They saw in themselves very much the Exodus story, correct?
That is true. And Mark, I think it's interesting. You can almost tell the story of America through the Exodus narrative. It was very much a part of the way that the Pilgrims and the Puritans saw their own experience. They were departing from England to escape oppression under the Stuart monarchs. They crossed the Atlantic Ocean, which was their Red Sea. They encountered forbidding terrain in the New World. They encountered the Moabites and the Philistines in the New World, and so they drew on this comparison, often to tortured lengths. But let me just add to that: they were not alone in drawing on this Exodus narrative. You see it in the founding era as well. We sometimes forget that on July 4th, The Continental Congress created a committee of three men made up of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams to design a great seal for this new nation. And what did they come up with? They came up with the image of Moses extending his arm out, parting the Red Sea so that the children of Israel could escape Pharaoh and his armies. So it's very much a part of the narrative of the American founding. It continues into the 19th century. It's part of the narrative of the abolitionist movement. And of course, we see it in the 20th century. Again, it's part of the civil rights story. They drew on this same narrative. And so we see it there with the Puritans, the Pilgrims, but it's woven very deeply into the fabric of the American story.
Now, I've seen people say that, well, yes, this is true of New England, but when we go to the southern colonies, Jamestown and others to the south, we find that was a secular commercial compact from the start, and that the religious influence wasn't nearly what one found in New England. What do you say to that?
Well, if you look at the founding charters of the Virginia Company, for example, it makes it very clear that there was a faith-based part to their mission. One of the first codes that was created in Jamestown, 1610, 1611, a code that's come down to be known to us today as Dale's Law, D-A-L-E-S, Dale's Law. To read it, you would think you're reading a document from Puritan New England. They were similarly drawn on Mosaic law in crafting rules and regulations for the colony there in Jamestown. So, there's certainly an element of truth that there was a spiritual calling to the Puritans that is not quite so pronounced that you see in places like Virginia, but you find that a spiritual mission and a reliance on the Bible to inform their polity is also a part of the Virginia experience. And we tend to overlook that. You're absolutely right.
Good. Well, one of the things that I wanted to focus on when we get down to the text is a new volume of essays that you co-edited on this very issue here. It comes out of a book that came out about seven weeks ago. I think it's called Great Christian Jurists in American History. You are the co-editor of that with Mark David Hall, who is at George Fox University. It's part of this series of Christianity, Law and Christianity, edited by John Witte Jr. It's an important series. You have dozens of volumes in the series. Cambridge University Press is publishing all those volumes. You have this new edition out, and the introduction is written by you. And here's something that I came across in the introduction that goes right along with what you're saying. You go to an influential 1775 Massachusetts election sermon, which is by Samuel Langdon, who was the president of Harvard and later a delegate to New Hampshire's Constitutional Convention, where he says, quote, "The Jewish government, according to the original Constitution, which was divinely established, was a perfect republic. The civil polity of Israel is doubtless an excellent general model, allowing for some peculiarities. At least some principal laws and orders of it may be copied to great advantage in more modern establishments." That's pretty late. That's 1775, where this, I mean, it's so explicit right there. And you imply this wasn't an uncommon.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is a very familiar theme in the American founding era. And when I speak of the founding era, I'm thinking just roughly the last third or so of the 18th century. I'm talking about that time in the life of the nation when the colonists began to agitate for their rights as freeborn Englishmen. And believing that they had failed to convince Crown and Parliament to grant them those rights, they then fight for and secure independence. So when I speak of the founding era, I'm speaking of this time in American history. And this theme of a model of republican governance to be found in the Hebrew experience is very common in both public papers as well as private papers of this era. And I give that example in my essay simply as an illustration. Literally, one could fill a small volume with similar examples. And again, the idea here is that if you read, let's say, Deuteronomy chapter 16, 17, 18, if you read the story of the Hebrew polity from the Exodus up through the coronation of Saul as king of Israel, there is a kind of republican form of government that has been ordained by God. And the Americans are saying there are lessons here that we can learn. Now, I think it's fair to say that they were not looking to the Hebrew Republic for the nuts and bolts of how to put together a republic. Rather, I think it was most useful to them because they believed it indicated that God favored a republican form of government, and that reassured them in putting together their own republics in the aftermath of independence from Great Britain.
You know, I had someone come in and lecture to my classes at Emory. I think I was doing colonial American literature and 19th century American literature. And he was one of the state humanities councils. Great guy, very, very learned. And he talked about the founders, and he talked about their notion of a republic. He only went to their precursor as the Roman Republic, you know, before the empire set in. He didn't say one word about Israel, nothing about the Bible at all. Why has this happened?
Yeah, that's not an uncommon story. And even in the telling that you give, you know, you're also missing out more modern republican thinkers, we might say. Think, for example, of Algernon Sidney. For example, a man who drew, by the way, on the Hebrew experience as well as more modern thinkers in his own time. So there was a rich body, or I should say bodies, of republican literature that was available to the Americans as they began to think about how to construct their own polities. And yes, the Roman experience was a rich source for them. But I think we miss a great deal if we exclude this Hebraic tradition. Now, I think the good news here, Mark, is that there's been a revival of interest in the Hebraic tradition as it was read and understood by Americans. So we're seeing a lot more being written about this topic. And hopefully, when you have that speaker in your class the next time, you'll have a richer sense of the variety of perspectives that Americans were drawing on.
Well, this is good to hear because, you know, I got a degree in American English, and I was in the last few years focusing on American literature. I got a very good education. It was kind of an old-fashioned system. We had huge reading lists. They made us take courses in eight different historical fields on our way to the doctorate. They didn't talk about getting published early on and going to conferences and to deliver papers, which is kind of a ridiculous thing for you know, graduate students to be doing. They made us really do our homework, and if we didn't do our homework, we got flunked out. A lot of kids did flunk out of the PhD program, but in all of that, I hardly ever, in my seminars on American literature, I hardly ever heard a word about King James, which was is there any more important book in American political, and I mean, what you're saying is political and legal history, than King James?
Yeah, I think that's right. You mentioned in your introduction, I wrote a book a couple years ago called Reading the Bible with the Founding Fathers. And I spent a lot of time looking at the biblical text that the American founding generation were drawing on, that they were reading. And the King James Bible, by the time we get to the 18th century, the King James Bible is the book that Americans are reading. We know from probate records, for example, that it was the most widely owned book in America. It was a book that was tremendously useful for literacy education. So when we think about Americans in the in the 17th and 18th century, there's a very strong likelihood that they would have learned to read with a copy of the King James Bible in front of them. The language of the King James Bible is particularly useful for literacy education, partly because it has a relatively short vocabulary, but the words themselves tend to be short words. So for someone who's just trying to master reading, this is an ideal textbook for them. But beyond that, the more overtly literacy education textbooks like the New England Primer drew extensively from the King James Bible and teaching people how to read. So, you know, this is the book that Americans would have known better than any other book. And you hear not only the language of the King James Bible in their rhetoric and discourse, but this is what I find very interesting. You hear Bible-like language. By that, I mean King James-like language. So they've adapted the rhythms, the cadences. For those who know the King James Bible know it has a very distinct cadence to it. And so oftentimes I run across a quote from the Bible, from the King James Bible, and I don't know that quote per se, but the mere rhythm of it tips me off that this is likely a quote from the King James Bible. And so it just is an indication of how deeply embedded in the culture this text was, at least for most Americans. And by the way, that continues, I think, into the 19th century and the 20th century. You can't read the words of Abraham Lincoln, for example, without hearing the rhythms of the King James Bible. Sometimes, such as in his second inaugural address, he draws explicitly on the King James Bible and the words of the King James. In other places, like the Gettysburg Address, he's using King James-like language for rhetorical effect. Take, for example, the Gettysburg Address. He begins with 47 years ago. Right now, if my math's correct, he could have said 87.
I think he's using too many words there. It's very verbose.
Not so eloquent as 47. But why? He's drawing on a mode of calculation that refined in Psalms 90:10, speaking of the number of years that man has on earth. And so what does he do from the very beginning of the speech? He's putting his audience in a biblical frame of mind, in a spiritual. He's saying there's something serious here, I have to say, but it doesn't end there. He goes directly into the phrase, "our fathers," evocative of the Lord's Prayer, or reference to the patriarchs, the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But he doesn't stop there. He goes, "brought forth." Brought forth is the language of Genesis chapter 1, speaking of the creation story. It is a phrase that we find throughout the books of Moses, describing Moses who brought forth the children of Israel out of Egypt. It is the language of Matthew, speaking of Mary brought forth a Christ child. And we could go through that entire speech and see line after line is evocative of the phraseology of the King James Bible. Now, let me just say, you're going to find the same phenomenon in the American founding era. Take, for example, the speeches of Patrick Henry. They read like lay sermons, drawing on the text of the King James Bible. The same was true of George Washington. He is always making reference to scriptural phrases. In fact, probably his most favorite phrase, his most favorite literary phrase from any source comes from Micah chapter 4, verse 4, when he speaks of a time in the future when every man shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree. Now, he appropriates that metaphoric language to refer most frequently to Mount Vernon. That was his vine and fig tree. But I could show you passages in the papers of George Washington where literally he will quote from five or six different biblical sources in the same sentence. Again, this is a generation that knew the Bible and knew it well.
It was the air. It was the air they breathed. You know, they heard it all the time. My focus in grad school and early years as a professor was 19th century American literature. Walt Whitman's catalogs you can find in King James. And again, the patterns, the rhythms, the cadences, and some of the diction as well. You know, the sublimity of Thoreau. Sometimes you can go back into the Old Testament prophets and get the same kind of Jeremiad. In fact, one of the most important books back in the 70s about colonial American writing was called The American Jeremiad. And Emerson as well, Hawthorne, of course, since Hawthorne read every word the Puritans had ever written and then had to read everything the Puritans themselves read as well. So it's and Melville loved the Old Testament prophets as well. It's all over Moby Dick as well. So now one thing you say in your introduction is, although Christianity remained a dominant force in the culture and the Bible's influence on law and constitutional tradition lingered, various 19th century rationalists, church-state separationists, and secularists began to challenge Christianity's influences on American law. When and why did this start to happen? And it's a big. I know we could talk for 5 hours on that, but give us the 5-minute response, Dan.
Well, there is this conventional narrative of the American founding period that says here's a moment in American history that's sandwiched between two great religious revivals. We have on the first end, on the front end, we have the Great Awakening of the mid-18th century. On the back end, you have the beginnings of what we sometimes call the Second Great Awakening. But part of the secular narrative, it says, in between was this moment of enlightenment thought. It's in the ascendancy, and religious influences are pushed to the margin. Well, I think there is an element of truth to that, but the religious influences didn't go away. We began to see at the end of the 18th century an increasing tension, a conflict over a variety of church-state issues, as well as the general role of religion in the polity. One of those issues, for example, was over the question of whether there should be an established church or not. You know, this was largely an unquestioned institution, this idea of a state church, going back almost 1,500 years in Western experience. But we begin to see challenges to this increasingly throughout the 18th century, and they sort of come to a head at the end of the 18th century. Now, there is a variety of motivations behind an argument for disestablishment. Some of the most ardent proponents of disestablishment were the most devout, and they believed that religion was most likely to flourish in an open marketplace of ideas where there was free competition of ideas. And so they advocated disestablishment in order to see a true, pure religion flourish. There were also those who argued for disestablishment that perhaps saw religion less beneficently, that thought perhaps that its role in society was not so healthy or desirable. And so there is an entrance into the American public debate on whether religion is in fact a healthy and good thing. And this begins, we begin to see elements of this in the late 18th century, and it begins to blossom more in the 19th century on a variety of fronts. We see them challenging Sunday laws, for example.
Let me ask you, what was the Sunday mail controversy?
Good question. It's a forgotten episode in American history. But it is really one of the first great church-state debates that we have following ratification of the Constitution. In 1810, Congress tried to clean up a whole body of odds and ends related to post office and post roads. This is one of the functions of the national government, was the maintenance of this. And in this 1810 law, they threw in a line that said that the post office had to be open, every day of the week for someone who wanted to pick up their mail. And whether there was an intent to disrespect observance of the Sabbath day or not, there were a number of very influential evangelicals in America who saw this as the first law passed by Congress that sought to undermine the role of Christianity. And so there was enormous outcry from largely conservative Protestant circles decrying this law. And Congress says they had never received more mail or petitions on any issue, more so than this Sunday mail issue, and they are forced to hold public hearings and issue a report. But interestingly, coming out of this debate, there is this recognition of a growing debate, a growing conflict on what exactly is the relationship of religion, specifically Christianity, to the civil government. Congress reauthorized that same law in 1825 or so, I believe. And once again, there was an enormous outcry. And again, Congress issued reports on the matter. But again, it shows this growing conflict over what exactly is the relationship of the national government to religion, to Christianity.
So it was partly motivated, perhaps, by commerce. Why should commerce stop on one day of the week? Doesn't that hinder productivity? Maybe that was a later argument made.
Well, no, I think you will find that some people make that argument. But the opponents of Sunday mail clearly saw it as part of a concerted strategy to diminish the influence of religion in American public life. Many of these would have been sort of the those who were following in the legacy of Thomas Jefferson, or at least as they believed Thomas Jefferson would have stood on these principles. Another major player in this debate would have been Andrew Jackson, who again saw himself as someone following in Jefferson's tradition, perhaps promoting this notion of some kind of separation of church and state. So there's a whole variety of arguments that emerge out of this debate over Sunday mail. Some are very pragmatic and commercial, as you indicate, but many of the arguments just get to the heart of this fundamental question: what is the prudential and constitutional relationship between church and state under the Constitution?
Well, I see your project, and maybe broadly the project of the Christianity and Law series, as correcting a historical record that has been falsified by secularists and progressives, libertarians of various kinds, that is in need of correction. And I'll ask one last question. Do you think that the recent cases that have looked like more of trending in a way, not always clearly, but trending in a way toward the protection of religious liberty, and I mean things like the Hobby Lobby case, the Jack Phillips case in the court of the Missouri Playground case, is there any connection, as you said, between the revival of scholarly interest in the religious foundations of American jurisprudence and maybe some trends we're seeing in the courts themselves?
Yeah, there may be. I think that the trend may go back almost a generation. You know, it takes a long time for ideas to filter up to the high court, if you will. I would say that there was some good scholarship coming out of the late 70s and early 80s that began to challenge a narrative that had taken hold in the 1940s and 50s, leading to some very strict separationist cases, such as Everson versus Board of Education in 1947 and McCollum versus Board of Education in 1948. These were cases that seemed to advocate a strict separation. In fact, the Everson case spoke of a high and impregnable wall between church and state, just to give you a sense of how they were characterizing this. And to go along
impregnable.
Impregnable. And they said, they went on to say, and we cannot approve the slightest breach, right? So there was this strict separationist interpretation of the non-establishment clause of the First Amendment that we begin to read about in the late 1940s and 1950s from the Supreme Court, leading on to the school prayer cases of 1962 and 1963. And these were cases that by their own claims purported to be driven by a reading of American history. And what we see in the 1970s, well, going back to the those cases themselves, but especially coming to a head in the 1970s and 1980s, a number of very fine works of scholarship that began to challenge the Supreme Court's reading of American history that they believed led them to the strict separationist position. And, you know, by the time we get to the mid 1980s, there's maybe one justice on the court who's even familiar with a different reading of American history. And that would have been William Rehnquist in a case called Wallace v. Jaffrey. And his dissent in that case, in a very lengthy opinion, he lays out the framework of an alternative reading of American history, one that I think is in fact more accurate. And so what we see, I think, in some of the more recent cases that you've just referenced is a coming to fruition of that body of scholarship as it begins to inform the way in which courts think about these topics. And so here we are today. Every justice on the Supreme Court, I'm fairly comfortable in saying, is now familiar at least with this history that you and I have been talking about. Some are not yet persuaded by it. Maybe four or five, maybe six are persuaded by it. But that's an enormous change from where we were in the mid-1980s. And I think that is beginning to inform the way in which the court has been ruling on some of these more recent cases.
The book is Great Christian Jurists in American History, Daniel Dreisbach and Mark David Hall, the editors. Thank you, Professor Dreisbach.
Thank you so much for having me.